folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actress and writer Emily Mortimer. You know, it's hard to believe that a person who chooses to be an actor, which is a profession ripe with exposure and vulnerability, could also be painfully shy at the same time. But that was the reality for a young Emily Mortimer, who couldn't even raise her hand in class without blushing. However, Emily handles her fear differently than most. Instead of avoiding the thing she's most afraid of, she dives in headfirst. As she tells it, "I couldn't be just a little less shy. I had to do the bravest possible thing in front of the most amount of people to overcome that feeling." It took some more bravery from Emily to truly commit to an acting career. As an Oxford-educated woman who was fluent in multiple languages, acting seemed to her a bit frivolous, not a proper job. And because she wasn't classically trained as an actor, she felt a bit like a fraud. It wasn't until she got the role in Nicole Holof Center's acclaimed Lovely and Amazing that her whole career started to make sense. It just took one incredibly emotional and physically exposing scene to get her there. As she says, "I was standing there butt naked for minutes while this man analyzed my body, and there was no dividing line between me and my character. I finally understood what actors meant when they talked about being in the moment. I could feel it." Since then, she's amassed an outstanding body of work in projects like The Newsroom, Shutter Island, Trans-Siberian, and more. She also co-wrote and co-starred in the miniseries Doll and M, loosely based on her life and experiences in the acting business. And these days, she's back on the big screen in the timely reboot Mary Poppins Returns to show us why, at this juncture in history, we could all use a little Mary Poppins in our lives. Emily joins Off Camera to talk about how real genius lies inside your inner child, about how a film set can make you paranoid, and why having a catchphrase isn't always a good thing. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Sam.
Thank you for doing this.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm trying to think of the first time I saw you, and I'm sure it was before this, but the first time you really made an impression on me was in Lovely and Amazing.
Oh, thank
and
you.
I love that film. I love that performance so much that I've referenced a scene in that film in other conversations on the show, and I want to get to that. But I love Doll and M. I was crazy about The Newsroom. And it's just, it's great to have you here, so thank you.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
And now you're in Mary Poppins.
I am.
And it made me curious right off the bat, going and doing a film like this, if it brought some magic back to why you started doing this in the first place.
Yes, I'm sure that's part of what was enticing about saying yes to being in Mary Poppins, although really, really what it was Rob Marshall, who is the director of Mary Poppins, who is a master who directed Chicago and Into the Woods. And I went to talk to him about this movie. I just got told that Rob wanted to meet me, and he kind of pitched the movie to me because there wasn't a script at that point that I could read. And I came away from having spoken to him. I just remember walking out of his apartment and ringing up my agents and just saying, I have to be in this movie. I want to be part of this man's film. And it wasn't really anything to do with the Mary Poppins of it or the kids' film of it or anything. It was just this guy. I think it's just as one gets older, there are very few benefits to getting older, but there's a feeling that, like, you're old enough to know that it's very rare to be excited by somebody else's vision. Like, it comes along very infrequently that there's a guy there or a woman there telling you about their movie and their hopes and dreams for this film, and you're getting transported listening to them, and you're thinking, I want to be part of this. I want to be part of this movie. I want to put something like this out into the world. And that was what happened in that conversation. He talked so uncynically with such kind of... he basically spoke about how he felt that we'd got to a moment in life where we kind of needed Mary Poppins to come back and revisit us as a culture. How this moment in our lives was one that kind of was calling out for this kind of visitation. And I just felt completely transported listening to him. And that was really what led me to, right. to want to do it.
It's very true. I think as we get older, we envy that inspiration and that excitement that we used to feel almost. And there's a nostalgia for that.
There's a fantastic quote by Coleridge, the poet, and he talks about the definition of genius as opposed to talent. And he says, he defines genius as being the ability to carry on the child's imagination in the man, to be able to think like a child as a grown man or woman is that's the definition of genius. That's somebody like Einstein or I don't know, John Lennon or whoever it is that, you know, is part of the reason that, or, you know, great scientists or whatever, that they're so brilliant is that they kind of still have kept on to their childish imagination. That they're
tap into curiosity and wonder.
They keep their curiosity. They're not jaded by life. They're not cynical anymore. They haven't become cynical when everything in the world is pointing towards cynicism as the only kind of coping mechanism. They retain their childish joy and enthusiasm, and that's what this movie is about. If there's a message in this movie, it's kind of that she's helping these sort of cynical, jaded grown-ups feel connected to their sort of inner child again. I mean, I think a lot of people have come out of watching early screenings of the movie and said, I feel like a Banks child. I need Mary Poppins. You know, grown men and women feeling
like... Well, it sounds like you did too.
And I think we all did, yes. And I think we kind of all do right now. It's funny, you know, Dick Van Dyke's in the movie, as he was in the original 54 yeah. years ago, and he comes on and just delivers the most extraordinary performance. He gets up on a table and does a tap dance and then sits down and delivers this monologue that's just perfectly pitched and makes you cry and funny and everything. And he's 92, I think. And he is almost the living embodiment of the sort of message of that movie, which is, I mean, he's still got that childish wonder and excitement and curiosity and joy. And it kind of just emanates off him. And you look at him dancing on that desk, aged 92, and think, God, that's how to be. Like, that's why you're 92, is that you just kept this joy. And I wish that I could be like that. Maybe we can. Maybe we can learn to be like that. Every time you start a job, it's kind of hope over expectation. Like, it's a kind of foolish endeavor in a way, making a movie, because the chances are it's going to be bad. I mean, there's very, if you're sort of looking at it in a kind of, you know, for, you know, in a rational way, you would actually never really do it because the chances are, you know, you're lucky if your mother and your agent ends up seeing the thing, you know what I mean? Like, especially if you do an independent film. The chances of it being good are slim. The chances of it being good and being seen are even slimmer. And so you have to have a kind of just sort of crazy, hopeful spirit and not be cynical in order to even embark on the very... act of making a movie.
Do you get any better at sussing that out by reading a script, or is it still like nobody knows?
I mean, I think part of the pleasure of it all is that still nobody knows, and it's like you're making this little ant hill, and you're all little ants, and you don't know what it is that you're sort of creating around you as it's happening, and you can have an incredible time doing it and then the movie turns out to be not that great, or you can have a really hard time doing it and the movie turns out to be pretty good. All I know is that the times that I've done jobs for cynical reasons, like either for the money or because people have told me that they think it's a good idea because they think it's going to be good for you. And so you end up doing it despite your kind of, your first instincts about it. I've always been right. Like, they've always been shit. I just think that my only kind of barometer or guiding principle is just to get a feeling of it that it was like, that if you're interested in it and you would like to help tell this story and you would like to help put this out into the world, and because God knows there's enough crap being put out into the world all the time. And so that if there's a feeling in you that, no, actually, I'd like to be part of this, I'd like to be part of bringing this to life, then It's not that it's going to be good necessarily, but you don't have to feel so depressed afterwards. It's like, oh no, I did that with the right kind of feeling in mind, which was, you know, not a cynical one. And that's the only way that it can, it's got any chance of being anything good.
It's so tricky because when you think of the arc of your life or someone who goes into this profession, you spend such a long time just trying to figure out who you're supposed to be and who you are and how to manage. And by the time you get to the point where you understand that stuff, you sort of can't help but have a bit of a more worldly or cynical understanding of it. You know what I mean? And it's like, when can you enjoy it?
I know.
It brings up Lovely and Amazing for me.
Yeah.
And maybe we can talk a little bit about the mindset of an actress. Because, like I said, on this show, I have brought up that scene. And the scene I'm talking about in Lovely and Amazing is you've just slept with Dermot Mulroney's character. And you've decided you want to stand in front of him naked and have him describe your body as truthfully and honestly as possible. All the flaws, and it's an excruciatingly vulnerable scene to watch. And it made me take so much note of you as an actress because I've never felt quite that vulnerable myself watching a movie. And I guess I was just curious if that was as vulnerable to film as it was to watch.
Yes, is the answer.
Or if you're just acting up there. No. Did it cross over?
Totally, it totally crossed over. And it was interesting for me. I mean, it's amazing that you bring up that scene because I do really feel like that scene was kind of the beginning of me being an actress in a funny way because up until I did that movie, it's funny. I'd always acted. I'd always wanted to act. I acted in plays at school all the time. I acted at university all the time. But I had a very kind of academic education, gone to Oxford University and studied Russian and English literature. And I was like, I had this feeling that if I was a really properly serious, proper person, I would do something serious and proper with my life. And I would go, I don't know, to Russia or work for the UN or something like that. And that acting was something a little bit frivolous that wasn't really a proper job and that all this money had been spent on my education and I shouldn't really piss it away on no, just pretending
really?
To be other people. And when I first started acting, I was in these kind of quite bad, like two or three in a row, quite bad. I mean, fine, but like TV sort of miniseries in England that were kind of like historical costume dramas, but not like the cool BBC kind, like the ones on ITV where it's like, you look like a sort of wig had fallen from outer space onto your head and you were wearing a crinoline and, you know, sort of romantic bodice ripper type stuff, you know? And I would dread people having seen anything I was ever in because I was always like, oh my God, it was so bad. And what am I doing? I mean, I kind of was enjoying it, but I wasn't feeling like this was like a sort of noble pursuit. It was all a bit like of a lark. But
so you were ashamed even though you were getting work on television.
Yeah, I had sort of shame vibes. And then I came to Los Angeles. I met my husband, Alessandro Nivola. And I came to visit him and we started having these conversations about acting and we were dating and I would say things like, oh, I'm so embarrassed by this thing, it's coming on the television, you know, I'm so embarrassed by this and that, and why did I do that? And he sat me down one day and said, why the fuck are you doing this? Like, you seem to be just mortified by everything you're in and why, like, if you're gonna act, acting's a really hard sort of, exposing thing to do. Why would you choose to do that when you could do a million other things if you just spend your whole life feeling ashamed and embarrassed? And I was like, God, you're right. And then I thought to myself, well, I'm gonna see what it's like to sort of take myself seriously as an actress. And I thought, okay, I'll try. I'll see what it's like to commit to doing it for a year.
Do you think you were afraid that if you weren't good in something and that thing you didn't even determine good enough, that it would be even worse?
Like, yes.
Like if you really tried and found out that
I couldn't do it. Yes, it was better to just not really try and to do sort of slightly crap things than to actually you know, it was vulnerable making to really put yourself on the line with something. And Lovely and Amazing was the first job I got after I made this decision that I was going to give it a real go and really see what it was like to commit to it. And I had never been to drama school. That was the other thing that was always playing at the back of my mind. It still does, that I felt like I had this terrible imposter syndrome because I hadn't trained and I just did it a lot, but I never, at school and college, but I'd never trained as an actor. I'd never sort of gone on the stage and, you know, all these things that people assume if you're a British actor, you were born on the stage, but I'd never sort of professionally been on the stage and I'd never been taught how to improvise or any of these things. And all these phrases like being in the moment, you know, these things that actors would talk about, being in the moment, would just strike terror into my heart because I didn't really understand what they meant by being in the moment. I didn't know what that meant. I couldn't even decipher what that meant, and I felt like I was probably never going to know what it was like to be in the moment because I was a bit of a fraud.
You know, it's a strange thing, I think, to think that others have some secret knowledge that you don't have.
I know, it's so silly because really nobody knows anything, but I still have the feeling. I mean, I still have the feeling. I still walk onto a set and every day I'm expecting someone to come and tap me on the shoulder and tell me it's time to leave and escort me out.
What do you grab onto when that feeling gets sort of strong to you?
You just have to keep going and just keep trying to kid people that you know what you're doing and try to put those voices to rest. But what happened with Lovely and Amazing was I got this part in this film that it was the first time I'd really tried and succeeded in being in something that I actually thought was great. Like, the script was beautiful. I'd seen Nicole Holofcener's film before that, Walking and Talking, and then suddenly there was this crazy, bizarre chance to be in her next movie, in playing an American girl, an LA actress in Los Angeles, and I'd only just arrived in LA, And anyway, I really wanted the part, and I got the part, and it was like
Did you audition for it?
Yeah.
Did you have to audition that scene?
No, I hadn't. That scene was something that I hadn't paid any attention to. I was just like, it was just like, she gets naked and stands there while he sort of, but it wasn't really written out. It wasn't like a sort of,
Jump out of the script.
No, I'd been in denial about it, because I was like, oh, well, I'll do that. That'll be fine. You know, I'd never really had a problem with being naked, because there's nothing you can do about being naked. You're just naked. Like, it's not like, it's much, much more pressure on you if you're trying to be funny or something, because it's more embarrassing to try to be funny and fail than to just stand there naked. I know, I mean, that's just, who cares, really? But the thing of standing there naked while somebody goes through, I mean, for minutes at a time, you know, while somebody goes through everything that's wrong and right about your physical being was quite weird, but it wasn't until, as I said, I was kind of in denial about it. I was just psyched to get this part, feeling terrified about having got the part, wanting desperately to do right by Nicole, and then it came to the moment where we were shooting that scene, and I had to get out of bed and walk across the room and stand naked in front of Dermot while he told me everything that was right and everything that was wrong about my body. And I can remember pulling aside the covers and thinking, this better fucking be a good film, because this is going to be really embarrassing if it isn't. and then getting to the other side of the room and just thinking, oh man, I just want my mum to come and pick me up and take me home now. This is horrible. And then standing there, and he started talking to me as I'd asked him to. I'd said, I'm going to go and stand over there and you're going to tell me everything that's good and everything that's bad about how I look. And I was playing this neurotic actress,
right,
who worries about how she looks. And I wanted to kind of have this experience where this one-night stand movie star guy would maybe it would help me if he actually just told me there and then what was right and what was wrong.
If I just got
an objective opinion. And he did it. He went along with it like an idiot. But what happened in that moment when I was standing there completely butt naked for minutes while this man analyzed my body was, at that moment, there was really no sort of dividing line between me and the character I was playing. I was her and she was me. I mean, I was as stupid, as vulnerable, as brave, as sort of lonely, scared, and everything as the person I was playing. I there was no line between us, and I was definitely in the moment, and I could feel it. Like, I could just feel like whatever was happening to the character I was playing was happening, really was happening to me, and it was an amazing feeling, and it was terrifying and weird, but it was really cool feeling. And then it stopped and it ended, and then I went over to the monitor and there was Nicole just crying, and it was really exciting, and it felt like, oh God, there is something noble about this job. There's something very cool about getting to inhabit somebody else, and the kind of empathy that gives you, and the kind of ability to see other people's stories from kind of being inside them, and to be able to communicate that to other people is special and odd and exciting and wonderful and something to be valued and not something to be embarrassed about. And I've just got to keep trying to work with cool people like this, because this feels right. And so that really, that moment that you bring up was a kind of defining moment in my career as an actress. And if I hadn't had that, I don't know that I would have necessarily carried on doing it. I would have.
Oh, really?
Maybe. I don't know.
Did you have moments where you were discouraged enough to quit?
Well, I just felt like, yeah, I think before I did that film, I felt, as I said, like, oh, I don't quite know what. This doesn't just feel, it doesn't really quite feel right. It feels like something approaching something that feels right. But I know what, from having done that movie, I knew what it was that I had to sort of look for.
Right, because you felt it.
Because I felt it, and I felt like what was so exciting was what it was really. And I had it with Rob Marshall doing Mary Poppins, and with all the great experiences I've ever had as an actress, it's meeting a filmmaker whose story you want to help tell. And it stops being about anything cynical. It stops being about you and how you're coming across, and whether or not you're good or bad or pretty or ugly or fat or thin or all the horrible thoughts that one has. It starts being about, oh, this is a really cool person who's got some weird shit going on inside their head that they want to share with the world, and I want to help them say it, and then it's fun.
It's interesting that, and ironic, that in the very scene where you're playing an erotic actress, an erotic actress who is worrying so much about her surface, it's when you found,
yeah, it's true,
the deepest part of being an actor and the most noble part of it is in the most superficial setting.
Totally, where I'm like, are my arms like chickens, and you know, is my bush too big or whatever?
Well, I was looking up that scene and I found two acting students doing that scene on YouTube, and they put themselves on it, and it didn't work at all.
That's amazing.
And it made me realize how ripe with alchemy the idea of filmmaking is, and it does give credence to the idea that nobody really knows why things work always, but that you have to seek that being in the moment thing,
yeah,
or you have to seek a truth of something,
yeah,
or else you can't transfer it to somebody else.
No, it's true. That's the only way that you can hope for anything to kind of work is just trying to find the truth in the moment of and I don't even know how one begins to know how to do it, and very often one doesn't. And I do think that the times that you really feel connected to what you're doing and really like it's happening and you're there and it's all working are very few, which is another reason why it's constantly frustrating and also constantly kind of addictive.
That's what you're chasing.
Yeah, you're that chasing feeling. That. Although sometimes you can work really hard and it just doesn't come because you're scared and there's something that's holding you back or scaring you, and you just get sort of paralyzed, and it doesn't matter how much work you've done, you just can't really kind of live and breathe in the moment and let things happen. But I don't know, just everything on a film set's conspiring to fuck you up. Like, there's so many unknowable things that are always going wrong. Like, there's one particular thing which is always a big thing, conundrum, which is, do you want to go first or second in the scene? Like, for your close-up, for your big your big take, which is the close-up, where they come in close on you, and that's where really they get the meat of your performance of the scene. Do you want to go first or second? And I always think I want to go second because I need to get a muscle memory about what's happened. I need to sort of have felt the scene in my blood and bones before I know what I'm doing, and then you can stop thinking about it. But so you need practice. So I like to go second.
And you like being off camera.
I like being off camera first.
To see what they did.
To see what they did, and then just have it feel part of your, you know, just you get under your skin. And I'm always too scared to say, can I please go second? Or, you know, I mean, you just don't want to impose yourself because it's like bad luck. Inevitably, something happens where suddenly you're going second, but they've got no time, so you've only got one take. Or,
right.
Or they were so brilliant in their close-up that then you're already thrown because you're like, I'm never going to be as good
as them.
They're
not going to cut to you anyway.
And they're never going to cut to me anyway. Or, I don't know, the light's going and they've got no time. Or then, I don't know. And then you're just thinking all the time, I wish I could have gone first because I'm now bored of saying these lines and there's no,
no magic.
Magic left. Or people are, you know, lunch, they're about to call lunch and they've only got one take left and that's your close-up. And I mean, there's just a million, or you're working with an actor that's kind of drunk or whatever it is. There's something.
Do you work with a lot of drunk actors?
No, but no.
Maybe that's the problem in the films that aren't working.
Yeah. But there's always something going wrong and there's always something throwing you. And then there's your demons in your head, which are telling you, like, you don't know what you're doing and you shouldn't be there and all that shit. So it's just a miracle when you walk away from a scene and think, oh, that was pretty good. I felt good about that. And so, yeah.
You know, in your series, Dahl and M, one of the things I find endlessly fascinating about that show is how spot on the understanding is of the nuances of a film set and the hierarchy. And there is a line in one of the episodes about how every day you're just trying to hold it together and not let an entire crew of people down. And I do wonder how you sort of deal with that pressure and at the same time find that lightness that you need to be able to do your art.
I don't know. I mean, I wonder if it's almost masochism or something. Like maybe there's some part of I mean, it's scary. Like, it's scary shit, man. It's scary walking onto a set and feeling like you've got to not disappoint people. But I'm sure that's part of what's compelling about it. And I mean, I was trying to tap into that a lot with Dahl and M, of that there can be a feeling sometimes of being on a film set that you're almost in a kind of noir film or something where you're kind of paranoid all the time that people, you know, every time you see somebody whispering by the monitor, you're convinced they're saying, what the hell are we going to do about this woman? She can't do it. That's terrible.
We've
made a terrible mistake. And
how much is it going to cost us to reshoot all our scenes?
And you're calculating in your mind whether, like, how much it will cost them to reshoot and whether or not they can afford it. Like, you literally, those thoughts are definitely going through your head all the time. It's just, it definitely is a job for, it's something, you know, I mean, it just makes you paranoid. Everything about it makes you paranoid. But it's so much part of my understanding of life now, feeling paranoid, that I'm used to it. I don't know what it would be like not to.
What do you think you love most about it? Is it just that you go into this trough of fear and insecurity, and then when you come out, that feeling of finding out you're safe is so good? It's almost like that feeling when you think you've lost your purse or your wallet,
yes,
or your phone, and then you find it. There's actually a bit of euphoria.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. Or when you don't crash in an airplane, and like you're actually like, it's almost worth the abject fear you were feeling for the entire flight to feel like I'm still alive. I'm so happy I'm alive, which you wouldn't have had if you hadn't been terrified for the last 3 hours. So, yes, there is. Of course, there's that. I just love the kind of folly of the whole enterprise of it, and that you're taking this insane journey with these equally insane people, and you're all trying to make this thing that is more than likely going to fail, but might not, and how kind of crazy it is, and how foolish it is, and yet there's something, you know, exciting and thrilling about it. And when it does work, it's It's so great.
So what happened that night after doing that scene in Lovely and Amazing? Like, what was sort of the takeaway from that, or the discovery that you made, you know, after getting through that sort of that scene where you discovered an extra level or an extra gear?
I just felt like, oh no, I want to keep doing this. I want to keep finding people like this, like Nicole and the producers. That just crew of people were just exciting, and they all had their heart in so much of the right place, and I felt just such an affinity to them. And so I was just like, oh, I've understood now how to kind of pursue this as a career, is to just seek out people that one feels that with. And so that really became the driving kind of motivation. But I remember when the movie came out, I knew it had an impact when I am, because one of the lines in the film, one of the tailor-made lines in the film is, you've got to do something about that bush. That you've got to trim the trim.
I do remember that line.
I remember.
And I thought, she's British. She's playing an American, but she must be British.
Yeah, no. Totally. I had no idea there was anything particularly. I said to Nicole, I think compared to an American girl, I might have quite a big bush, but I don't know. So she wrote that line in. Anyway, I was at the YMCA in Hollywood about a month after the thing came out, and some woman shouted, I was on some sort of like step machine, and the woman shouted out, you gotta do something about that bush, man, what the fuck? I was like, oh my God, this movie's obviously striking a chord.
You're like, why couldn't I get the you had me at hello line? Why can't that be what I'm known for?
Exactly.
That's my catchphrase.
Yeah, that's my thing. The woman with the big bush.
Well, we've had a lot of things on this show, but so far we haven't discussed that. So I'm glad we finally
got there.
Yeah, and I'm glad my kids are here too.
I know, and mine is too. Now I think of it. Oh God.
Well, he knows. He came from there.
Yeah, no, but don't.
Mom.
He's never going to talk to me again.
God. You know, that's just a conversation stopper right there. Where do you go from there? What's the transition?
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. I interrupt my own conversation to talk to you about this week's sponsor, Quip. There's a buzzy gift that should be on everyone's list this year. It's something they'll use twice a day. It was featured on Oprah's O List, and it's perfect for everyone with a mouth. This gift is Quip. An electric toothbrush designed to make brushing better. And you know, when you think of the perfect gift, you probably don't think of an electric toothbrush. You probably think of a 2019 450 Factory Edition KTM motocross bike, or a 1964 Seafoam Green Fender Stratocaster. Those are the obvious choices for perfect gifts, but what about an electric toothbrush, battery-powered, that you can take anywhere? It looks like it was designed for the space shuttle. It gets rid of the idea of bulky cords, and best of all, every 3 months you get new brush heads delivered right to your door. That's the perfect gift for the holidays, and that's Quip. And I can tell you, I use this toothbrush every day. I got one for everyone in my family, and we love it. There's sensitive sonic vibrations that are gentle enough on sensitive gums, and a built-in timer with guiding pulses to remind you when to switch sides. And as I said, Quip makes holiday travels clean and easy with a multi-use cover that mounts to mirrors and unmounts to slide over the bristles for on-the-go brushing. Because we all know about taking a toothbrush on a trip, and the second day you pull it out of your bag and you realize the bristles have been rubbing up against your razor or your lotion or whatever, and it's gross. Not with Quip. Quip's the gift that keeps on refreshing, with brush heads automatically delivered on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5. And you can even gift prepaid refills for a year to make sure they're never using old, worn-out, or ineffective bristles. So yes, Quip is the perfect gift, and I can say it makes brushing a breeze, and you should get one for every member of your family. They have thousands of verified 5-star reviews, and it looks like a big-ticket tech gift, but it has a stocking stuffer price, starting at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/offcamera right now, you get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at gitquip.com/offcamera. So give Quip, and you're giving the gift of a healthy smile and better dental visits. And twice a day, you will be thought of as a great gift giver. And we could all use a little bit of that. So check out Quip at getquip.com/offcamera today. Now back to the show.
Let's talk about Doll and Him.
Okay, more. Let's
because
look at Doll and Him.
I love what you created. For people who haven't seen it, you're playing a version of yourself, and your friend, Dolly, is playing a version of herself, and you play the more successful actress where she is the woman who's just broken up with her boyfriend in London. She comes out to live with you, and you have this brilliant idea that she can be your personal assistant.
Yes.
And anyone who spent any time in this business understands the paid friend phenomenon.
Yes.
That happens when someone hits a certain level of success and they want to be around people
they trust
that they
and
trust
love,
and yeah. that know them and that treat them like a normal human being. But I was curious if that initial inspiration came from you sort of seeing that odd relationship in the business of people that had.
Yeah, it definitely did. It came from Dolly and I. You know, we're really tight. Like, we're really, like, we've got a really sort of unhealthily close relationship, me and Doll. We've known each other our whole lives, and we're kind of inseparable. And she's often been, you know, with me in situations where we've been kind of, I don't know, I've taken her as dates to various things,
awards,
things, and premieres.
Right.
And so we've just spent a lot of time together, kind of observing this entertainment showbiz world or whatever that we're both in, and kind of gossiping about it afterwards. And yeah, one of the things that we really kind of was fascinated by was this the paid friend phenomenon, because it's just so bizarre. Because I mean, on the one hand, yeah, you totally understand why that would make sense, and it does. I think it works often very well
yeah.
for people. But there's just something weird about this kind of, because very often they are the same. These two people, the star and their personal assistant / best friend, are, you know, they're from the same socioeconomic background, they're the same age, they're the same sex, they kind of look alike a little bit. And they're very close, and they're each other's bridesmaids, and they are godparents to each other's children. And yet the kind of unspoken white elephant in the room is that one's a huge movie star and the other one's their servant, kind of.
Right.
And it's
right.
like, how does that work? Because they're best friends too, but so, like, are there any times when the movie star will get the best friend something to eat or drink, or is the best friend only ever serving the other? And when do they get paid, and how do they discuss money, and how do you discuss, like, needing a raise with your best friend / movie star best friend? Like, and I don't know. And so there's so much room for awkwardness and
yeah.
weirdness, and it would just appeal to our sort of sick sense of humor how to kind of excavate that as a relationship. And we just, it was so pleasurable. But there was something that we were touching on, I think, which was the kind of subject of jealousy, and how that's kind of a taboo subject, but it's something that we all feel a lot. Jealousy is something, I think, an emotion, a human emotion that everybody feels a lot, you know, a great.
And no one walks in a room and says, "I'm feeling jealous."
No one owns up to it, because it's kind of embarrassing and it's not
yeah.
cool. And actually, you can't really tell the person that you're feeling jealous towards about feeling jealous towards them, because it's just not very nice for them to have to deal with you feeling jealous of them, and you're ashamed of the feeling yourself, and so
right.
you kind of shut up about it, and it never really gets outed as a thing. And I think that it's something that people feel all the time towards. Often towards the people that they love most in the world. And that's the paradox that I found most interesting, was that, okay, yeah, of course you're jealous about people that you've never met who are getting jobs that you'd quite like, but more often than not, you feel kind of jealous of or threatened by people that you know and love having great things happen to them. And on the one hand, you want the world for these people, of course. You want everything for the people that you love. You want them to succeed desperately, and are so happy
that
they
are. But you
just
want to be succeeding at the same rate
yes,
at the same time
and
with
of
them.
Course, the minute they yeah. do, it makes you think about yourself and think, oh, well, maybe I'm a bit shit because they're, you know, so great. And, oh, gosh, well, if they're doing so well, what does that mean about me? And I think you're always comparing yourself in a way. And that's normal, but it doesn't really ever get outed as an emotion.
Yeah.
And I think we found kind of pleasure in delving into
Well, the writing's so good, and I think what your show proves and what all great work proves is that the more personal it is, the more you touch on things that seem very specific to you, those are the things that people really respond to and connect with.
Yeah, you have to be brave about, you know, both in writing and acting and any of it, about, like, yeah, really telling the truth. The minute you're telling the truth about something, people respond to it, and it doesn't matter how ugly the truth is.
Did you discover that?
Yeah. Well, I think I've realized it all my life, just, like, in my life, that was the only thing, in a way, that kept me sane was by being able to talk honestly about things, feeling weird or uncomfortable or life being hard or being an idiot or whatever. Like, as long as you can say it, it's okay. And as long as you can communicate the kind of the pain and the agony and the mortification of being alive, you're safe somehow, and people get it, and
right.
I don't know.
Did you find that your critical voice over your writing was as powerful as your critical voice of you as an actor?
Oh yes, definitely. But it was so fun having Dolly to do it with. That was what was, because in a way, I don't know, it's just like you've got your best friend there and you want to make it good for them, and you're sort of trying to impress each other and make each other laugh, and anything that kind of, as I said, anything that takes you away from trying to kind of do something that's great, like anything that takes you away from the kind of result-oriented motivation of, like, this has to be good and I have to be great and I have to prove myself and be fantastic, is that's just death. I think the minute you think like that, you've lost the plot. You're not doing something for the right reasons, and it shows, and it becomes, you know, an exercise in vanity, and then you're lost. And as a writer, you know, collaborating with your best friend and trying to make each other laugh and trying to outdo each other in a way as to how to get to the truth and the hilarity of a situation the quickest and the funniest or whatever, it stops you I don't know. It stops it being self-serving, and then you're in good shape.
You know, there's a line in the second season where Dolly rather flippantly says, "Writing a play is rather easy. I don't know why everyone makes such a fuss about it." And it just made me think, like, I wonder if what you were actually saying is, if you can get out of your own way, that 90% of the hard thing that people talk about with writing is the gearing up to do it, or the talking about it, or the pushing it off or worrying that it's not good enough.
I think that what we were trying to do with that was have Dolly's character just be constantly this infuriating person to whom, sort of just blithely going through, having never sort of acted before, suddenly is a great actress and just doesn't have any fear and is brilliant and is producing tears, you know, in the back of the shot when I am failing to cry
right.
in my big moment. And then we start writing a play and she's like, "This is pretty easy. I don't know what all the fuss is about." And there's just something so maddening about this complete neophyte who's, you know, and I think it's just, you know, the... how you can get into your own head and get in your own way as a performer by taking, you know, and you start putting all this pressure on yourself and taking yourself very seriously, and then someone comes in and there's just has such an ease and a kind of facility for it, and it's just kind of infuriating. And in fact, that happened to us, because all our family were in Dolly and Em. Our mothers were in it, our children
right.
were in it. They were all brilliant and gave the most incredibly natural performances, and all of them to a man kept saying, "I don't understand why you make such a fuss about this acting thing. It's so easy." And it's kind of true. It's like, you know, why do we get so het up about this thing? Because it's kind of, all you're doing is just, I don't know, pretending to be someone else. And as long as one has a sort of, I mean, you see it in children all the time, because they're fearless. It just comes so easily to them, and they're on their, you know, they're on their iPhones, or they're running about making stupid jokes and just like screaming and eating too much candy, and then suddenly that it says that, you know, it's turnover, and there they are right there delivering this brilliant performance, and you're like, God, that's just, you know, I don't know.
Can you still surprise yourself?
Yes. Oh, God, I don't know. Yes. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, it's like a freelance work we do, so every situation is different. And so every time you start a job, it's a completely different set of circumstances from the one before. So in some ways, you are always starting again from the beginning and having to deal with... I mean, you never become a professional in a way. You're always like an amateur because you're always... you know, you're suddenly in a different country where nobody speaks the same language as you, and you're, you know, I don't know, whatever, or you're in a musical and you've never done that before, or you're with some kind of demented director who you have to navigate, or you're whatever, and you've never played this part before, and so I feel like you never really feel like you never really have learned what it is that you're doing, and so you're always starting again and feeling both the wonder of that and the kind of terror of it. So I don't think you long to be back at the beginning of your life as an actor, because you just feel like you're always at the beginning no matter what, and that's fantastic but also kind of slightly annoying, because it's like, God, I'm old enough and have worked long enough at this thing that I wish I did actually feel like I knew what the fuck I was doing at this point. But
you feel like, yeah, I should somehow like have some peace,
yes,
on set, right?
And if I'd been working as a sort of company or something, I'd be the CEO by now. I'd be like, I don't know.
But you could come in at 11 and leave at 4,
exactly,
and have a long lunch.
Exactly. It's marvelous, but it's, yeah, you never feel like you've got a handle on it really necessarily, I don't think.
Right. I wonder if you did have a handle on it, if that would be sort of the death of the work.
I think so. I mean, I know from myself that the times where I felt the most scared and the most like I can't do it and I don't know what I'm doing and how the hell do you begin to even know how to play this part have been the times where I've kind of, I've probably been the best, just because it's almost like you just... all you can do is kind of hold your nose and close your eyes and jump into the unknown. And whereas when you kind of think you know, it's a bit dangerous. I think it's better when you don't have a clue.
What's an example of sort of an indelible memory of one of those nightmare days when...
I did this part in Shutter Island, this Scorsese movie,
yeah,
where I had to go mad. I had to kill 3 children and then... be in an insane asylum, and I
as one does
and have this kind of mad scene, like this Ophelia-esque mad scene, and I walked onto his set. I'd met him in the audition, but it was my first day on set, of course, and it was this huge mad scene, and I'd done a...
Why does that always happen?
Oh, I don't know. But I was doing a play in New York at the time, and I the play had opened the night before, and I'd had to get into a car, drive to Boston to start filming the next morning, and walk onto this set, and there was like Leonardo DiCaprio and Sir Ben Kingsley and Mark Ruffalo and Martin Scorsese, and I had to go mad in front of them all, and it was just me, really, just going mad.
And in your head, they all know what to do, and
yes,
they know their jobs.
Yes, and I really haven't a clue, and I have watched like one documentary about people that kill their children, and spoken to a guy. I did speak to a guy that had worked with a lot of women that had killed their own children. But I was just like, this is insane. I mean, this is just like, shoot me now. I can't do this. I don't know how can I do this? And I remember wandering around my trailer, waiting to go on, and just thinking, this is just horrible. Please don't make me do this. But then you walk onto the set and you just have to do it. There's no getting away from it. Like, you just have to. And in a way, yeah, that was one of those moments where it was just like, okay, it literally did feel like that, jumping off the side of a cliff. It was like, hold your nose and close your eyes and just do it, and just do it, and go for it. And something kind of, I don't know, I'm a naturally very shy person. It may not seem that way, but I was very, very shy as a child, really cripplingly shy, so that I couldn't sort of hold my hand up in class without blushing.
Really?
And I think I learned early on as a way of combating shyness that I had to kind of do the opposite. I had to really, like, go on stage and, like, take off all my clothes or whatever in order to that was the only way I could kind of deal with it. Like, I couldn't just be a little bit less shy. I had to, in order to really kind of deal with the situation of how shy I was, I had to just be do the most, the kind of the bravest thing in front of the most people to sort of overcome that feeling.
And you had to go mad in front of Marty Scorsese.
I had to go mad in front of
That's
Marty Scorsese.
It's the only way to cure the shyness.
Or to take off all my clothes and stand there for 3 minutes. In a Nicole Holofcener movie or whatever it was. I remember having the same feeling. When I was at school and I did this debate for the English Speaking Union when I was about my son's age, I was about 15. And I hadn't really ever done anything in public before. But I wanted to do this debate, and I was speaking on, I was talking about anarchy or something, and I'd written this speech, and I can remember walking up to the podium to deliver this speech. And thinking, I can't do this. I want my mom to take me home again. Like, this is just horrible. Why am I doing this? And like almost seeing my heart beating in my chest and then standing up there and then just something happening where just the act of forcing yourself to do it, you're sort of protected or something because you've been so crazily, insanely brave. It's almost like this hand reaches out to take yours and just goes, "Come on, you're going to be all right." And you have no choice but to hold it and go. And I don't know. It's like jumping out of an airplane or something. That everything in your body is telling you not to, and that you shouldn't, and that it's an insane thing to do, and that it would be much safer not to. But the minute, and you're like that. But then the minute you jump, there's no going back, and there's an incredible freedom about that feeling of sort of no going back, and it's just me now, and I have to do this, and there's no choice, and I can't back out of it. And then I think something kind of sometimes quite magical happens, because you're just like free-falling.
Wow. Do you ever wonder where that impulse came from? Because there's a lot of people who would just go, that profession is not for me.
But it's some kind of coping mechanism. I don't know. In a way, it is a cure for it. It was like, you know, just do the, you're very, very shy and you're kind of, nervous of social situations or going out into the world or putting yourself out there. But then really the cure is to do the thing that scares you the most. I mean, it's like aversion therapy, I suppose, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
You know, they do that in therapy. You know, you're scared of flying, so you do to go and sit in an airplane for, you know, whatever. Or you're scared of birds, lock yourself in a room with a bird. And so I just know that I was somehow impelled towards doing it. And then when I did it, it felt kind of okay. I mean, up until the moment that I was actually doing it, it was terrifying. And but the feeling of being there doing it felt good. Felt like, okay, I can be sort of free in a way in this environment that I never feel quite when I'm not in this
right.
environment. I did a film called Trans-Siberian with Woody Harrelson years ago. But he said to me on that job, he said, "You're that got it so strange. He said you're so scared and yet you're so brave at the same time." He said, "You're the scaredest brave person I've ever met." I feel like that kind of is a sort of definition of me, both as a person and as a performer, where I'm just, you know, kind of terrified and yet quite foolhardy at the same time.
You know, it makes sense thinking about the way someone grows up as a child and the things they run up against and what they choose to do with those things.
Yes, totally.
Now, I wanted to finish with something. You know, your father fascinates me, and we didn't get to talk about him really, but he fascinates me because he started out as a barrister,
mm-hmm.
became a writer mm-hmm. of fiction. He wrote about this barrister character,
yes,
right?
Yes, Rumpole of the Bailey.
Right, and I also read that he wanted to be an actor, but his father talked him out of it.
Yeah, he was a huge influence in my life. I miss him all the time. He was a completely doting and adoring father, and talk about a childish sensibility. I mean, he was an incredibly smart guy and a very kind of renowned barrister and novelist, as you said. And he defended an awful lot of murderers. He only ever defended. He never prosecuted anybody. He believed firmly in the principle that everybody has the right to a fair trial. that we're innocent until proven guilty, the presumption of innocence. He loved murderers. He generally thought murderers were some of the nicest clients as a lawyer he ever had, because they generally got rid of the one person on earth that was irritating them. And a kind of peace had descended over them.
Well, there's a life philosophy to follow.
And he also defended a lot of...
Here's how to be happy, people.
He did a lot of free speech cases. So he defended the Sex Pistols.
He did?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
And then I think he defended the Monty Python for Life of Brian, or he gave them advice, the Monty Python team, about, because all these things were being prosecuted under the Obscene Publications Act. The Sex Pistols were prosecuted for the use of the word bollocks in that album, Nevermind the Bollocks.
Right.
My dad got an etymologist who was a Church of England vicar to come and say that bollocks was the rigging on a 17th century man of warship, and that there was absolutely nothing obscene about this.
Yeah, and the Sex Pistols, they weren't even worried about the rigging on a 17th,
no.
on a 17th century
but
ship.
The judge was
never
very,
mind
the
that.
The judge was
that
very,
rigging.
Very happy about this and decided that that was absolutely the case. And of course, mustn't be convicted of having done anything obscene. He was a great person a huge figure in my life. And I think this, I mean, I say that rather glibly about this, murderers were his nicest clients, but I do think it was an important education that he gave me about people, which has really helped me as an actor, that have a lack of judgment, you can't judge the people that you're playing, no matter what they may have done or no matter how badly they've behaved. And that he gave me that too, that there's sort of the paradox of morality and life and that you can be a good person and kill someone. Plenty of people kill people and they're not necessarily awful people, but you can be a very nasty person and never get a parking ticket your whole life and abide by the letter of the law and that we have to sort of, not think in a black and white way about people and the situations they find themselves in and the ways that they behave, it's an extreme example but that murder is kind of can be a very human crime, and that there are plenty of crimes that aren't.
And you're right, a great lesson for an actor of not judging a character. And I think that we've all seen the performance where the actor is also trying to tell us that...
Yes, that they...
They don't believe... they can't...
What they feel about their character and that the character...
Right.
Either make apologies for their character or try to make them nicer than they are, or try to sort of make them more kind of socially acceptable or feeling like, oh, this guy's a bad guy because he did this bad thing, so I've got to play a bad guy. I'm playing a bad guy or a good guy.
Right.
And that,
it's judgment to start right
off.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. Do you think that your father, if he hadn't encouraged you, do you think you would have ended up where you are in terms of acting?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, he definitely encouraged me. But I kept saying to him, why didn't you stop me? I thought that your job as a father was to tell me not to do this. Like, aren't you meant to say, don't on any account go on the stage? Your life will be a misery, And you're meant to tell me that I should do something more sensible with my life, and you never did. And he was always just enchanted by actors and wished that he could have. He would have liked to have been Fred Astaire and walked down a white staircase with a silver-topped cane and worn a top hat. I just wish he was still here. I just wish he could see my kids, grow up, because they're so cool, and I hear his voice in them all the time, and the things that they find funny, and just the kick they get out of certain things that I just think he would have got such a kick out of too. And that's sad to me, but he's there somehow, chuckling about it all, I hope.
Well, listen, it's fascinating to talk to you.
Thank you.
And it's been lovely, and it's great to get to know you a little bit.
Thank you. I'm so happy to have been here and chatted to you. You made it very easy and painless.
Thank you. We strive for painless.
Yeah, it was totally painless. It was actually it was better than painless. It was fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey folks, that's our show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Make sure you check out Emily in Mary Poppins Returns. And if you're like me and you have little kids, you'll probably see this film multiple times. She is great in it, and it is well worth your time. I would also highly recommend Doll and M and The Newsroom. And of course, Lovely and Amazing, where everything got started for her. And if you want to see where everything got started for us, go to offcamera.com. That is the website compendium to this show. And if you're just a podcast listener, you might be surprised to see all the different ways that we share off camera with people. For instance, on our website, you can find a digital magazine and also complete access to our off-camera television show. You can see every episode in our archive on any device you want, as many times as you like, for only $4.99 a month. It's a great way to dive deep into the show, and it supports what we're doing. So go to the website, check out our archive, see all of these amazing artists that we've talked to, and if you're loving this podcast, please take a minute and subscribe to it so it shows up on your device automatically every week. While you're at the iTunes store or wherever you get your podcasts, take a minute and give us a rating and a review. That helps other people find us, and that helps grow the show, which we would really appreciate. Another way to help grow the show is by talking about us on social media. If you have an idea for a guest, or you want to comment on the conversation or join in on a topic that we've discussed, do it through social media. You can find us at Off Camera Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Also, I'm Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. And if you follow me on Instagram, you'll see a lot of photographs from the show because I photograph each guest that comes here. And one of the parts that I really enjoy about the show is being able to make a portrait visually after we've sort of made a portrait through a conversation. So you can see all those pictures and get some behind-the-scenes stuff on my Instagram account. I want to thank everyone that helps us on this show. Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Sasha Snow, Michaela Galvin, Kara Johnson, and Matt Davidson, who had successful surgery to remove that really hairy mole in his armpit. So congratulations, Matt, and hope you're healing up nice. I also want to give a special shout out to our sort of unofficial sponsor on the show, Vans Shoes. If you watch the show, or if you listen to the show, you can probably feel it. I'm wearing Vans shoes, and I have been since the beginning, and they're the shoes I grew up skateboarding in, and I still love them. And Vans has been kind enough to send me shoes and let me wear them on the show, and then I go get them dirty, and then they send me another pair. So thank you to Vans, and if you're not wearing Vans right now, or if you don't own a pair of Vans, I think you should rectify that. Go to your local Vans store, check out their classics, my personal favorite, the Old School, and also their high tops. If you're a skater, you can't go wrong with those. Or their half cabs, which is a great skate shoe. And it was designed by my friend Steve Cavallaro. So lots of choices out there. So thanks to Vans for helping us out. And be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actor, writer, and master impressionist Steve Coogan.
The paradox of good comedy is the more effortless it looks, the harder the work is that's gone into it. It's like a curse because people think it's disposable or ephemeral or kind of nothing. And also because you're laughing, they think it's kind of trivial. But in actual fact, good comedy will make an audience laugh of disparate people from different creeds, different backgrounds, different classes, different political persuasions. You can say something that's funny about being a human being that everyone will laugh at the same time in agreement with that observation. And when you look at it from that perspective, then you suddenly appreciate how powerful it is and can be.
Steve's character, Alan Partridge, is comedy royalty in England, but I became aware of Steve through projects that made it to America, like 24-Hour Party People, Happy-ish, and The Trip. I was also not aware that this very thing that made him a massive success became a personal albatross for years. The English press was especially harsh, claiming that Alan Partridge was the only thing Steve could do. So Steve decided to prove everyone wrong and prove to himself that he was more than an impressionist, satirist, and comedian. So he wrote and then starred alongside Judi Dench in his film Philomena, which was nominated for 4 Oscars and forever put to bed the debate that Steve was a one-hit wonder. His account of that personal journey is fascinating, and it proves that he is capable of doing just about anything he sets his mind to, which includes his new film, Stan and Ollie, in which he plays the classic film star Stan Laurel. He can also do a pretty great Michael Caine impression. See you next time, off camera.